You're listening to 2A Radio with Bill Carnes.
Yeah, isn't that like a sharp pointy stick to the eye first thing in the morning? Guys, I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in live right here to 2A Radio. Welcome to the show, everybody. Little bit of information about 2A Radio and your host, yours truly, Bill Carnes. I have been in the shooting sports since 1989, which is relatively short if you actually think about it, 21 years at this point. I got my first rifle when I was 19 years old. I was 18 years old when I got my first rifle. I still own it today, Ruger 10/22. I got my first handgun at 19 years old, and there was really no turning back after that. I took my first formal firearms training course for my 25th birthday, and I went to Gun Sight in Paulden, Arizona, and I finished top of my class in the handgun 250. I was the only one to shoot a perfect score on test day. It's 5.5 days. It's Monday through Friday, full days, and then a half day Saturday. I don't know if that's still the format. That's the only class I've actually taken at Gunsight. However, I have been on the property other than that. And what a fantastic experience that was. From there, I went on to be a police officer for Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. I've been an NRA certified instructor for a long time, which doesn't really say much. The NRA certification is more of a piece of paper, not really an ability. I moved on to be the lead rangemaster at Front Sight, where I became one of only two guys that have ever worked there as a recognized and qualified five weapons defensive rangemaster. That's where I am qualified to rangemaster the weapon systems, handgun, shotgun, rifle, submachine gun, and precision long range sniper, counter sniper type rifle from basic into and through the advanced level. So there's a little bit of qualifications and information on me. You can always find out more at BillCarnes.com, C-A-R-N-S. There is no E in the last name. So BillCarnes.com, you can find more information on me. When it comes to the show, you can always go to 2A Radio. 2A stands for Second Amendment. The official name of the show is the Second Amendment Radio Show. We just shortened that down to 2A Radio. So you can go to 2aradio.com. Plenty of stuff on there, including all of the archives. At the end of each day, the show goes up within about 30 minutes or so, including show descriptions. Every single show since its inception back of March of 2009 is up. Now, what do we discuss here on 2A Radio? Well, the foundation is all Second Amendment related. However, that's not the only thing we speak of. We also speak about First Amendment rights and basically any rights that are out there. And usually we bring them up when some government jackass or some government entity decides to want to consider or just simply does subvert some sort of right from you, me, or anybody else out there. We talk about police and more specifically police abuses from having worked in the policing industry as a patrol officer for Las Vegas Metro. I have firsthand experience in good cops and bad cops and what they do. I speak quite often about guns, gear, tactics, techniques. If you have any questions about guns, gears, tactics, techniques, rights, anything like that, you can always email me. And my email address is bill@2aradio.com. So feel free to send me any sort of comments, questions, suggestions, whatever you like. Oftentimes, say hunting season is coming for big game. You want to sight in your rifle, get some information going on about guns, gear, bullet selection, how to sight in, where to sight in, cleaning procedures, whatever that might be. Send those things in to me, bill@2aradio.com, and I will either answer you directly or, if it's good enough and I feel that the audience would probably benefit in hearing the answer, I'll hold off and I will add it right here onto the radio show. So there's a little bit of format and formula for you when it comes to 2A Radio, yours truly as the host, and really what to expect for this next hour. Stay tuned, guys. There is plenty more to come, and you are tuned in live right here with me, Bill Carnes, hosting 2A Radio.
It's not an option. It's a right. Cocked, locked, and ready to rock the world of the anti-gunners. You are listening to the guy who had to register his mouth as a full auto weapon. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio. The fight for your rights isn't for pansies. So buckle up for the ride and knuckle down with Bill Carnes and 2A Radio.
And a good morning it is indeed. You know, I've had several different long guns that I've needed to take out to the range and go do sight-in confirmation or whatever it is I needed to do with the things. Take them out to the range, I need to shoot them at a specific distance. So, Saturday was the day, and I got to tell you, the weather Saturday was gorgeous. Virtually no wind. And where I shoot is down in kind of a valley of sorts so that we are ill affected by wind. There's not much wind that goes through there. And when it does go through, it's not a crosswind. It blows straight through. So it's what's called a zero value. We don't get a crosswind in this neat little trench of a valley that we shoot in. So I went out there with several different rifles and several different game plans and had a bunch of specific targets that I use. I've designed these targets. They just print out on an 8.5x11 standard letter size sheet of paper. And it's a diamond, and they have grids. And the grids, some of the papers that I use, they're 1-inch grids, and other I actually get down to 1/4-inch grids, so they can truly figure out minute of angle with these things. And I shoot at a diamond as opposed to a circle or a square. The reason is if you do a diamond, you've got a point on the top and bottom and a point on the left and right sides. Therefore, you can line up your crosshairs perfectly, provided you actually hang the target straight and you hold your scope and your rifle straight. The scope is on the rifle properly and all the other good things, all the conditions are there. You end up getting a perfect setup for being able to align your scope on a diamond to truly make sure that this thing is lined up, ready to sight in. Well, I own a Steyr Scout Tactical. In 308, and it's a Jeff Cooper designed scout rifle. The only reason mine happens to be the tactical version is because it's all black. There's no gray on it. I guess if you make something matte black and maybe stick Velcro on it or something, it officially qualifies for being tactical. Probably some ballistic nylon piece. Anyhow, it's a great gun. It's a 5-round box magazine capacity bolt action rifle. And it's got a spare 5-round box magazine that fits into the buttstock, underneath the buttstock, an integrated bipod. I actually have a regular scope on it. The whole top end is a long Weaver rail. I have the scout scope for it. I also have a standard scope. Plus, it has pop-up emergency sights. So what I did was I first sighted in the scope itself. And it was off a little bit. I banged the gun around just a little. So on a rough trail, and I didn't have the gun put away in the box properly. Whatever, you know, beat up the gear, it's gear. So anyhow, I resighted the thing in. Then I took the scope off. It has quick-release rings. Then I sighted in with the backup, flip-up iron sights. And then I put those down, and I put the scope back on to reconfirm sight-in and see if I could actually take the scope off, put it back on, and if it would return to zero. It returned to zero beautifully, which I was incredibly surprised. That just to get a true return to zero is almost unheard of. It's just something that just really does not happen very often. But it worked out great. So got about 50 rounds downrange out of that gun. Chronographed everything, so the ammo that I was using to get that good sight in, I have all the information together on that, so it worked out really well. Then I moved on. I have a Remington 700 22-250, and it's called an E-tronics, which means it's an electronic firing trigger. They made these guns for about 3 or 4 years and stopped making them probably 5 or 6 years ago. I wanted mine as a varmint shooter, you know, prairie dogs, coyotes, vermin, squirrels, whatever, and long range. So this Etronics rifle, it takes a special primer. The rest of the round is the same. It has the same casing, same powder, same bullet, but it has an electronic primer, and it looks different than a standard primer. So I brought that thing out. That's one of the guns I brought out to reconfirm sight in, because last time I shot it, I sighted it in. However, the way this thing works is you take the butt pad off, you put a 9-volt battery, I'm not kidding you, it's actually a battery-operated gun, put a 9-volt battery in it, put the butt pad back on, and then it goes through some circuit board that is in the butt stock. You press the trigger, it goes through a circuit board and like some flux capacitor or whatever it is, that juices it from 9 volts at the battery to 150 volts to actually zap the primer. Now, the beauty of the Etronics rifle is lock time, or lack thereof. The lock time is the amount of time that it takes from the time the trigger breaks until all of the mechanical pieces actually ignite the primer and begins to fire the round. Now, usually that's measured in thousandths of a second for a standard gun. This Etronics is measured in milliseconds. 27 millionths of a second is how fast this thing ignites from the trigger break. And the trigger's beautiful. It's just this little tick. And the other great thing is this. Because it's not mechanical firing, the bolt doesn't have extra lugs that have to be reset when you bring the bolt up to run it to the rear and chamber a new round. So it's actually very easy. It's about a 60-degree throw, if I remember correctly. It's about 60 degrees on the bolt. Anyhow, I get everything ready to sight that in, chronograph, everything. What happens? The battery dies. That's what you get for a battery-operated gun. Now, I would not have a battery-operated AR-15 or a battery-operated Glock, but for a prairie dog, sort of something like that, and I have other rifles that I can use to back this one up if it doesn't work. It's a neat trinket, you know. They say, everybody's got a unique opinion. I've got to have a unique gun. So, anyhow, that not everybody has a gun like this. It's kind of cool. As a matter of fact, I ended up with 200 rounds of standard 22-250 ammo I got at an auction. 100 rounds each of two different types of ammo. And what I ended up doing was I took each round apart at my reloading bench, and I would pop the bullet. I would take the casing and dump the powder out. I would then pop that primer out. It's a large rifle primer. And then I would pop an Etronics primer in, and then I would put the very same powder back into that case and the very same bullet seated to factory depths in there. And then I then had, after doing that, 200 rounds plus 200 additional CCI primers. So it worked out very well. CCI large rifle primer. So anyhow, I've now got an extra couple of hundred rounds. And the primers on that thing, oh my God. You got to be kidding me with this. Most primers you can get, it used to be about a dime a piece for primers. You know, it was about $10 for 100. Now, they're between $30 and $40, but these Etronics primers are actually about $180 for 1,000 primers. $180. I remember one time having purchased 1,000 rounds of Indian mil-spec, NATO-spec, surplus 308 ammo. All right, 7.62 by 51. 1,000 rounds of 308, military surplus type of stuff, for $99. And a few guys that I shoot with a lot bought several cases when they were even cheaper, $89. You have to add $100 on that for me to even get 1,000 primers to load for this gun. Anyhow, then I brought out my AR-15, and I sighted in, confirmed sight in with the iron sights, and then I confirmed sight in with the ACOG, and by that time I was done for the day. I had another couple of rifles in there, but just I spent so much time. I was literally 6 hours. I got out there. I actually set up a shade structure next to my behind my truck. I'm actually going to upload a couple of pictures of this whole setup to my Facebook. If you ever want to follow me, I have a public page. It is Bill Carnes / to a radio fan page. You can always go on Facebook and check that out. Just type in to a radio and or Bill Carnes, C-A-R-N-S. There's no E in my last name, although a lot of people like to do that. No big deal. I see it all the time. But to a radio, Bill Carnes / to a radio fan page. You can check it out. Again, I'll put up a couple pictures. But I had my regular 308 long-range precision sniper rifle out there. That was just going to be a sight-in confirmation. I didn't bother with that. Ended up putting everything away. My buddy Scott was out there with me and doing some sight-in with a 22 caliber AR style Smith & Wesson rifle. He actually put his military style ACOG off of his standard LaRue AR-15 on there and sighted it in. And that was just kind of neat. And then he put it back on to his LaRue AR and reconfirmed sighting with that, you know, shot up a bunch of targets. And we just had a good time out there for several hours, a couple of buddies, had a cooler full of food and some snacks, and we just had a good time and got filthy dirty, man. I got to tell you, 2 pounds worth of dirt. Anyhow, we'll continue on after the break. I'll tell you a little bit more about some gun working on after we return. So stay tuned. This is Bill Carnes, live here on 2A Radio.
Tell everyone in the room to pipe down. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
And welcome back. I tell you, I had another gun project that I did over the weekend. The very first gun I ever bought was the summer I was 18 years old. I went and I bought a brand new Ruger 10/22 rifle. A great starter gun for just about anybody. I still own that rifle today. I have gone through a lot of different guns in my life since I first bought that one. But this one, it's a good 22 caliber rifle. And you know, it's reliable, it's relatively accurate, it's easy to use, it's ergonomic. You know, it's kind of like the Chevy 350. What a Chevy 350 is to V8 engines, the Ruger 10/22 is to 22 rifles. You can get basically almost any accessory for Chevy 350. You can build it into anything. A race motor, a longevity motor, a four-wheel drive motor with a lot of torque or a lot of horsepower. You can put a blower on it, a turbo, whatever. Same thing with a Ruger 10/22. Everybody in the world that makes accessories for guns makes something for a 10/22. Anyhow. So I took my 10/22 apart. And by this, I mean all the way apart. Now, I've had the thing down pretty far before, but this time I took it all the way apart with one exception. I didn't actually take the safety out of the trigger group. I had no need to do that. I could clean that the way it was. Now, and it's interesting, too, because the internal parts of a Ruger 10/22 are a combination of aluminum and metal. So there's aluminum where we can get away with aluminum and get away with a little bit of weight reduction, and then actual steel where we need to have steel parts. So it's a very good combination. A couple of intricate little parts in there, but it's not really that big a deal. So I took the whole thing apart, and the way that I tend to clean a gun is I would work very well back in the day of Henry Ford putting together the assembly line form of production. I am kind of an understudy of Henry Ford. He was a brilliant man that came a long way. And just some of the things that he realized and some of the things he said were wonderful. He actually said one point, he said, when we're creating a new assembly line job, what I want you to do is put a lazy man on the job. Then, once he figures out the simplest, easiest way to do it, I want you to replace him with a hard-working man. Because a hard-working man will just sit there and work hard doing whatever it is you tell him. A lazy guy is going to sit there and figure out the easiest way in the world to do something, the most efficient way of doing something without burning up so much energy or effort or excess wasted motion or movements or time. So once you get the lazy guy that figured out the most efficient way to do it, you put a hard-working man on there doing it the way the lazy man trained him to. Anyhow, I'm kind of that way. So what I do is I have in my I have a very large laundry room, and I have an extra cabinet in there. In the sink, I have in there a 5-gallon parts washer. And in the parts washer, I have a solution called M-Pro 7. M-P-R-O-7. Or M-Pro space number 7, I guess it is. And it's a carbon cleaner is what it is. It's biodegradable. There's not any harsh chemicals. You can get it on your skin. It can go down the drain, blah, blah, blah. So I have a very finely meshed wire basket that I put all the little parts in. Every tiny little gun part you could ever come up with, nothing will ever get through the wire mesh. That's how fine the mesh is on this. And I soak it in the M-Pro 7, turn the sprayer on, and put the sprayer on there to agitate. And then after, you know, 10, 15 minutes or so, I turn the sprayer off, I bring the thing up, I let it sit there and drip drain, and all the M-Pro 7 comes off. I put it onto a towel, I wipe everything down with a towel, and then I run it through a silicone or Teflon impregnated rod and reel cloth. So I did that, did all of that with the Ruger 1022 once I got everything completely broken down. Then I went through on every internal part that showed any sort of wear off the factory finish or in the trigger group, and I took 1,000 grit wet dry sandpaper. I put a little bit of gun oil on there, and I lightly sanded it just to get the finish off and smooth up those areas. What this will do is this will give you a crisp trigger break, not a light trigger break, but a crisp one. What I mean is, on most Rugers, and most a lot of guns in particular, if there's any finish that's on any of the trigger parts, you will not get a crisp break. A trigger should break like if you hold a thin, long, tubular glass rod, put your thumbs in the middle, and just snap it. It should just all of a sudden break. It's not going to bend, twist, grind, scratch. It's just going to break. That's the way a good trigger break should be. After doing all of that, getting everything cleaned off, getting everything sanded down smooth to a beautiful bright finish where the wear marks otherwise were, and then putting just a little bit of my favorite silicone, I guess it's a Teflon grease of sorts, and then I put the whole thing back together, reassembled it, tested it, and that 1022 has a little bit of slack to come out of the trigger, a little bit of pre-travel, if you will, and then a perfect snap. It's not any lighter, but it is smooth and perfect. I love it. Now I've torn that thing apart and put it back together, I got to sight it in. So, anyhow, we got more to come, guys. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're tuned in right here to 2A Radio.
You're listening to a guy who packs a gun to shoot the bad guys and packs a mic to shoot his mouth off. Bill Carnes and 2A Radio are back.
And welcome back. You know, probably the single biggest anti-gun blowhard that this country has. I'm not saying they're the most anti-gun or the biggest blowhard, but you put the two together, anti-gun blowhard, is the corrupt, degenerate mayor of New York City by the name of Michael Scumbag Bloomberg. I call him corrupt, and I refer to him as a scumbag for the following. New York City had a term limit of 2 terms for any mayor. Now, on September 11th, 2001, it was a Tuesday, that happened to be election day in New York City, and one of the elections they were voting on was Mayor Rudy Giuliani's replacement because he had served his two terms. He was at the end of his second term. He was lame duck, if you will. There was no way for him to be mayor again. Well, of course, that election was postponed, and the candidates, you know, same candidates ended up on there. And Michael Bloomberg bought his way into the election. Now, of course, he's billionaire from Bloomberg Investments and Bloomberg this, that, and the other. But this guy, he's a real scumbag because towards the end of his second term as mayor, again, lame duck, what he did was he did a legal form of money laundering and payoff to the city council to get them to change the municipal codes to where he could run for a third term. That's why 9 years after 9/11, Bloomberg is still mayor. Reason being, he bought his way into, paid off the rest of city council and bought his way into being mayor for a third term. So, that's what we've got. He is also the guy who started a coalition called Mayors Against Illegal Guns, or MAIG. Now, it has nothing to do with illegal guns. What it is it's Blowhard Mayors Against Guns. BMOG is how I look at it. Blowhard Mayor Against Guns. Anti-Gun Mayors of America. AGAM. Anti-Gun Mayors of America. AGMA, I guess. It has nothing to do with illegal guns. It has everything to do with guns and disarming people. Now, Bloomberg has just further disgraced himself in his latest anti-gun pitch. Now, New York's current murder rate pales in comparison to what it did in 2001, only because there was an extra nearly 2,700 murders on 9/11. But it also pales in comparison to what was other years gone by, due in part to crime-fighting programs adopted under the former mayor Rudy Giuliani's administration. New York City's murder rate is only a fifth of what it was 20 years ago. Now, presumably, New Yorkers are well aware of the relative safety in which they live today. However, the current mayor, Bloomberg, has a very skewed perspective, even though the September 11th anniversary is front and center this past weekend on every news outlet across the country. Now, especially centered in New York. So, with New York City and the nation's murder rate lower than any time since the 1960s, and keep in mind, in the 1960s, you had about half as many people in this country as well. Bloomberg sounded the alarm saying, quote, illegal guns and their accompanying violence devastate communities across our country. All right. Bloomberg revisited his perennial cause about gun control because his anti-gun group, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, has an issue brief urging Congress to, quote, close the gun show loophole. Gun control supporters, Orwellian doublespeak for prohibit private sales of firearms at gun shows and everywhere else. Now, let's discuss this gun show loophole, as they call it. There is no loophole. Somebody has a gun show, and you get a bunch of retails that show up there to sell guns at the gun show. A bunch of people who are into guns and gear and equipment and ammo and scopes and, you know, bipods, whatever you want to get, and oftentimes beef jerky and books on guns and ammo and whatever. These are the type of people that show up. If I have a gun that I'm interested in selling, there is no better place to find more prospective buyers than at a gun show. Now, you might have seen this. If somebody might be walking around with a rifle slung over their back, or maybe a shotgun, and there's a dowel going down the barrel with a sign taped on it, or just maybe a little sheet of paper taped on it, anywhere on the towards the top of the muzzle, the top of the barrel at the muzzle, that says something, you know, for sale, you know, Remington 870, 10-gauge goose gun or whatever. Our Remington 700 308 PSS for police shooting, whatever it is. Whatever the 700 PSS stands for. And people will look at that, oh, hey, yeah, let's talk. And this is just a private citizen that's in there. All right, they're not a gun dealer. They just own a gun. For some reason, they want to offload it. Well, the anti-gunners call this a gun show loophole because there's no background check. There's no Brady bill. There's no sales receipt. There's no form 4473 for the ATF, which is perfectly legal. Perfectly legal. If I work with somebody and they want to buy a gun, I want to sell a gun, you don't have to go through any of that garbage. You don't have to go through a dealer in most parts of the country. I think in California you do, New Jersey you may. In most parts of the country, you don't have to. So, if there's not already an anti-gun law in your state against private party transfers, there's no problem at the gun shows. Now, here is where the anti-gunners really try to put this thing home. They really try to sell this falsehood by saying, this is a place for criminals and felons to purchase guns as at gun shows because of the gun show loophole. They can do this parking lot deal and walk out of there with a gun. You know, they could do that out of the newspaper as well. All right? It's that simple. Now, if I have a gun and I want to sell it, I don't want to go through the expense of putting an ad in the paper and having everybody in the world call and, you know, re-explain throughout a weekend or have to figure out whatever, you know, however long I want to have the gun in there. And then if I sell it and it's a week-long ad and I sold it on day two, I got to answer the phone for another 5 or 6 days and or go through the process of trying to sell it through some online source like GunBroker or Auction Arms and then pay them their fee. It's a hassle. It really is a hassle. But if you have a good-sized gun show, you can just trot around, you got that gun on your back, and if somebody wants to buy it, you've got it with the sign on it, it's all good to go. The anti-gunners call that a gun show loophole, and they want it to be made illegal to do that. Total BS. Okay. Now, since U.S. crime rates are so low in comparison to the last 20 years, from 20 years ago, MEG invoked Mexico's war with its drug cartels, repeating the same garbage soundbite first heard in early 2009 when attorney scumbag General Eric Holder tried to use Mexico's problems with drug violence as the excuse for reinstating some federal assault weapon ban, the Clinton era piece of garbage. In fact, 90% of guns recovered and traced from Mexican crime scenes originated from gun dealers in the United States, Meg says, which is a total lie. We exposed that here on 2A Radio in 2009. Total lie. 80%, they're saying, in fact, 90% of guns recovered and traced from Mexican crime scenes originated from gun dealers in the United States. That is false. Close to 90% of the guns that Mexican officials realize have got to come from America that are turned over to the ATF for tracing, which is less than 1 in 5 that are actually recovered. Less than 1 in 5 actually make it to the ATF. Because sometimes it's plain to see. It's obvious this gun wasn't from America. The ATF gets them. And then they say they come from the United States, not from gun dealers in the United States. So this is a lie. Gun dealers. No, that's what they're trying to then implicate is that you and I and everybody else, especially in the border states with Mexico, are going into these gun stores and buying these guns and somehow selling them to Mexican drug cartels that are either on our side of the border or smuggling them across. Because there's some big reason for doing that, but there's be a lot of money in it or something, who knows. And we smuggle them into Mexico and sell them to the drug cartels there. It's lies. It's the State Department's direct arms sales program that they broker and approve and send to Mexico or other countries, and through one level of corruption or many, they end up in the hands of drug cartels. So Meg and Bloomberg are just lying through their teeth. It's no surprise. Now, discovering that geography is more than a subject taught in elementary and middle schools, Meg adds its revelation that, quote, 4 in 10 of the U.S. guns recovered in Mexico between 2006 and 2009 were originally sold by gun dealers in Texas. The three other states that share a border with Mexico, Arizona, California, New Mexico, were the source for another one-third of U.S. guns. Again, total lies. And the ATF has even come out and said, yeah, that's not accurate. Of course, Meg is not listening. They're going to show to older reports prior to ATF coming out and saying, yeah, that's garbage. That's falsehoods. Of course, the operative word is 90%, and the sound bites are the and traced. So Gun Owners of America also reported that most guns seized in Mexico from cartels or anyone else have not originated from the U.S. For example, in 2008, of the almost 30,000 firearms that the Mexican Attorney General's office said were seized, only 7,200, or approximately one-fourth, were submitted to ATF for tracing. The others were not even submitted, presumably in many cases, because their markings indicated that they were not traceable to the U.S. So now we're talking about 1 in 5 was actually traceable to the 1 in 5 that they received in Mexico, that they collected, actually came from the U.S., and the vast majority came through the State Department sales. Okay, so for all their effort, Bloomberg and all of the other Meg idiots got scant coverage by the news media, thank God. But the debate is likely to continue over how many guns are smuggled from the U.S. to Mexico, what percentage of the cartel's guns originate from the U.S., and from which countries the cartels obtain their machine guns, grenades, and other weapons that are untraceable in the U.S. Now, Meg isn't going to look into that, and Bloomberg and his other blowhard fools are not going to look into it, not going to look into it at all. They're just going to use the sound bites. But one thing is for sure, Americans have greater access to U.S. guns than does anybody in Mexico. And our murder rate pales in comparison to those of our Mexican neighbors down south. For example, the murder rate of Juarez is nearly 100 times higher than that of El Paso, and they're just across the border. There is a dried up, what used to be riverbed. If anything, that's a criticism of Mexican law, which prohibit honest people from getting guns with which to protect themselves. So good job, Bloomberg. You are just, honest to God, for a guy that's so brilliant in some areas in business, you are a complete, total, and utter idiot. I mean, what an idiotic moron. So, you know what I'm going to do after this? When I'm done with my radio show, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out to the range and I'm going to shoot some more. I'm going to hook up with a guy I met recently who works with a couple of Nevada pro gun groups. And we're going to go shooting some assault weapons, if you will. Some semi-automatic rifles. What are not assault weapons? In fact, an assault weapon is something that is full auto or select fire by sheer definition. We're going to go out with our sport utility rifles, or you could call them maybe counter-assault rifles, because if somebody assaults me, I'll probably grab one of these guns. We're going to take our sport utility rifles and our handguns. We're going to shoot at steel targets. We're going to do some cover and concealment movement exercises, individual drills. We're going to take on some team tactics sorts of drills, like two-man team tactics stuff, transitioning between handguns and rifles. We're going to go. We're going to have a good time. You know what we're going to be doing? Celebrating our freedom to actually shoot guns and protect ourselves. What do you think about that, Bloomberg? What do your armed bodyguards think about that? Do you let them get much trigger time, Bloomberg? You don't want anybody else to protect themselves, but you and that other filthy scumbag hypocrite in Chicago, Richard M. Daley, both carry on with all kinds of armed bodyguards. You hypocritical scumbags, you sicken me. Folks, stay tuned. There's more to come after the break. Stay tuned in right here to 2A Radio. If you live in a state which allows Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories, and you either have an interest in or already own Class 3 NFA items, the process for an individual to own these items includes photographs, fingerprints, obtaining a letter of permission from your police chief or sheriff, and a full personal background check which is spread across the whole federal system. Until now. Forming an NFA trust eliminates the requirements of letters of permission and all personal data and background checks in purchasing and possessing NFA firearms and accessories. NFA trusts offer a level of anonymity as well as flexibility in the purchasing, possessing, and storage of your Class 3 NFA firearms and accessories. To learn more about forming a secure and flexible NFA trust at a fraction of the cost from attorneys, visit www.billcarnes.com and click on the NFA tab. That's BILLCARNS.com and click on the NFA tab.
As long as politicians attack our rights, Bill will be fighting for them. 2A Radio with Bill Carnes is back.
Back up, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong if this is not where you belong.
Well, if you go out and you want to buy a gun, if you're under 21 years, you're 18, 19, or 20 years old, you want to buy a handgun, you can't do it from a licensed firearm dealer, a federal firearms licensee. You cannot go into a gun shop or a gun store, a store that sells guns, that has an FFL license, a federal firearms license, and you cannot buy a handgun if you're 18, 19, or 20. You have to be 21. Although you're an adult at 18 years old, you can buy a long gun, a rifle, or a shotgun, and you can buy a handgun through private party sales. I bought my first handgun legally at 19 from a guy who was actually a park ranger, actually was a state cop. So, the NRA is challenging the constitutionality of this federal law, which is banning 18 to 20 year olds from buying handguns. They filed this lawsuit just last week. On the laws that prohibits law-abiding Americans 18 to 20 years of age from legally purchasing a handgun through a federally licensed firearm dealer. The case was filed last Tuesday evening in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas in Lubbock. James DeCruz of Lubbock, Texas, is the plaintiff in the case. Now, in Heller and McDonald, the U.S. Supreme Court clearly stated that the Second Amendment guarantees a foundational individual right to keep and bear arms for law-abiding Americans. These are the words from Chris Cox, Executive Director of NRA's Institute for Legislative Action, NRA-ILA. That's right, it's not limited to Americans 21 years of age or older. Indeed, throughout our nation's history, adults beginning at age 18 have served in the military and fought for this country with honor. But while the Supreme Court has consistently made clear that the federal government cannot ban or unduly restrict sales of items protected by the Constitution, the federal government continues to prohibit these adults from purchasing handguns from federally licensed dealers, which represent the largest and most accessible means of purchasing handguns. So, we now have a suit against the ATF regulations, really. And that's a good thing, guys. The suit is asserting that at 18 years of age, law-abiding citizens in this country are considered adults for almost all purposes, and certainly for the purposes of exercising the foundational constitutionally protected rights. Indeed, at 18, citizens are eligible, and male citizens could be conscripted to serve in the military to fight and die for, but with arms for this country. There's no reason that they shouldn't be able to actually buy a gun if they're already law-abiding. That's the way I see this issue. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Thanks for tuning in. Bill will be back tomorrow. Now go side in and shoot straight. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. Learn more about Bill at BillCarnes.com. Send your comments to Bill at 2aradio.com.